As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Garrett Joyce and Ryan Dixon. Lots to get to. A bit of a chilly Saturday morning. The NHL teams out in Alberta, they still stink. One of them re-upping their head coach, while the other one was dumping theirs. World Juniors' first exhibition game getting underway yesterday for Canada. 2-1 overtime loss to Russia. So the sky is falling, obviously. Raptors win again against another sub-500 team. And the Blue Jays still waiting on them to do something with either second base or the bullpen, while the Padres blowing their brains out trying to grab every outfielder there is in Major League Baseball. But we start with the Toronto Maple Leafs, who play at home, as you heard on the update, for the last time in 2014 tonight, as they will host the Philadelphia Flyers, coming off that 4-1 loss to the NHL's worst team on Thursday, the Carolina Hurricanes, who are no longer the NHL's worst team, picking up those 2 points, snapping a six-game winning streak for the Maple Leafs. First period was pretty ugly. Got back into it with Dion Phaneuf's goal in the second period, made it 2-1, but then allowed a power play goal, empty net goal, and the Maple Leafs see their record fall to 19-10-3. And guys, this to me is a perfect example of what the Maple Leafs are, right? I mean, they go buck the trend for their 11 games, for six straight games. They win games they're not supposed to win. That 2-1 shootout win in Detroit against the Red Wings, they had no business picking up 2 points, but they did it for six straight games. You go into the home arena of the worst team of the National Hockey League, and I don't know if you get your doors blown up, but you lose 4-1. You give up four goals to a team that had scored one goal in like four straight games. So what do you make of this stupid team?
Well, let's be fair. Carolina's only the second worst team in the league.
That's right. Now they are.
Yeah. So attach an asterisk to it. We're going to find out what this Leaf team is, on this roadie. This is, it's crazy. I think if you had told the Leafs, their management, fans, whomever, they're going to be 19-10 in ties, right? They would take it. But, it's a question of, do you have to go 4-3 on this road trip?
They would take 4-3 in a New York second.
I think they would take 3-4.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth. But we're going to see what they're made of on this trip.
Yeah. All of it.
I think your microphone's not working there, Ryan. We'll get you to slide over to the other microphone. But yeah, you look at seven-game road trip. Starts on Sunday, Rogers' hometown hockey in Chicago. You got the Blackhawks. You got Dallas Stars, who were playing a lot better these days. When they came to town last time, they looked like one of the worst teams in the National Hockey League. And the Leafs could have scored about 20 goals in that game. In Florida, Panthers team is playing not too poorly. Tampa Bay, Boston, Minnesota, Winnipeg. So seven-game road trip. It's not exactly the beast of the National Hockey League. Chicago's pretty darn good, and Tampa Bay, obviously. Boston's had a bit of a step-back year. But it is. It's going to be a bit of a litmus test here, Ryan.
Yeah, a huge test. And, obviously, given what has gone on the past, not one, not two, but three seasons with the Leafs, where there's been an unbelievable catastrophe of some sort at some point, there's always trepidation around the Leafs to begin with. But because of the recent history, yes, there's, a lot of people who are really hesitant to put lots of stock in what's going on. They're waiting to get burned.
Everybody's waiting for the trap door to open, right?
Sure. I agree with Garrett. They would take 3-4 on this road trip in a heartbeat. And even though you can still point to some of the metrics and say, as much as things change, they stay the same kind of thing. There are some reasons to look at the Leafs and say that things are a little different. The back end's been a little better than it's been in recent years. And I think the big story could possibly be the emergence of Nazem Kadri. Are we seeing him right now establish himself as a really good, rounded out NHL center who's really at, I think, 24 now, starting to realize what he can do, what he needs to do every night, because that would be a huge development for the Leafs.
That's the Leafs' number one line right now, the Kadri, Santarelli, and Daniel Winnick line, right? Like, they started the game against the Hurricanes. It doesn't really matter who starts the game, but seems like Randy Carlyle has the most faith, and understandably so, in that line. He was out front in saying that he sheltered the Bozak-Kessel line in the previous game, but he's not afraid to play that Kadri line against just about anybody, and they've really emerged.
Yeah, well, and I also think, though, that giving them, you know, that push, in turn, that's sort of a catalyst or a prompt to get the Kessel JVR Bozak line going. You know, like it's forcing them to raise their game.
But is it okay to have one line that you're happy with as your number one line 5-on-5, and then have this great offensive line that's not so great in their own zone and can really do damage on the power play, and then you throw Kadri onto the point on the power play as well? Is it okay to have a number one and then a number 1A line like that? I mean, it's pretty clear that, and justifiably so, that Randy Carlyle doesn't have a whole lot of faith in that Bozak, Kessel, JVR line at 5-on-5.
I think that's going to round back into form, though. I mean, I do think, starting with Kessel, obviously, he is a good enough, I mean, he's a really, really talented offensive player. Is that ever going to be a perfect line as presently constructed? Perhaps not. But I have to believe those three guys are going to find a way to get themselves on the score sheet, at some point. I think the 5-on-5 play, the 5-on-5 production will pick up a little bit. So a lot of this, too, comes down to semantics. People want to label this the number one, that the number one. The bottom line is, if you can get two offensive lines producing, that's great.
Plus, during that game, they were jumbled up as well. I mean, there was some line juggling during that game. But you look at this Leafs, and I mentioned it kind of played right into the script, that loss on Thursday to the Hurricanes, because you go back to the middle of November where the sky was falling after a couple of losses. The 2-1 loss to Pittsburgh that started that 3-game losing streak, I don't know if you can point to that and say, oh, that was the beginning of the end, because the Leafs played half decent in that game, had a chance to win. But you go into Buffalo, and maybe the Sabres are a little better than we gave them credit for at the time, but you lose 6-2, come back home, and then the 9-2 loss to the Predators, and it looked like, okay, Connor McDavid and Randy Carlyle and all that, and it's going to be a joke the next, you know, few months here before the season's out. They come back, beat the Lightning in Stickgate, and then that was the talk of the town for about a week. But then they go on this incredible run, and now are we going to have the letdown of Thursday, and maybe they lose against a not very good Flyers team again tonight, but then they go on another run of 12 straight games. Is that okay way to run your hockey team if you have these incredible ups and incredible downs?
Oh, it's tough on the nerves of the fan base, I'm sure. No, it's not ideal. I mean, of course. But you know what? It's like a goal scorer. Like, everyone wants a 40-goal scorer to go out and score every second game. But that's not the way it works. You score 10 goals in 10 games, then you don't score for 8. Realistically, things are a lot more streaky like that. You know, the Detroit Red Wings, I think, are still viewed as a pretty solid team. They've lost 5 in a row.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
Yeah. You know, it's funny when you're talking about the number one line. I mean, one thing is, the number one line you can figure out if you're looking at the payroll, right? Like, whoever's paid like the number one line
is going to play the most.
But that was the next thing I was going to get to. I know years back, I remember talking to Doug Wilson about it, and he said, you know, who scored the most goals per 60 minutes played in the league? And I said, well, it's easy. It was Mario. And he goes, yep. You know who number two was? Right? And I was thinking, like, I can't put it together. It was Alex McGillney this season way back. And I was thinking, he's on the Devil's second power play, right? and some guys in a McGillney-type player actually play better when they're not playing as much. And I think that might be what we're seeing with Kessel, is that he's better when you're not playing him 22 minutes a game. it looks like he's not a first liner playing less time, but you're getting more a more intense focus Kessel, you know, in that limited time.
Plus, there's reports that he might be nursing some sort of minor injury, right? So that helps.
And maybe even getting some better matchups if other teams are more concerned with Kadri, right?
Yeah, I mean, Randy Carlisle talks about sheltering that line. It also means they get to face, you know, third and fourth line of the Anaheim Ducks and maybe look a little better, which is a luxury you can afford when you have four actual lines, which this team does appear to have this season as opposed to last. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Garrett Joyce. One of the takeaways, again, from Thursday's game, Jake Gardner was god-awful. Really, really bad. First goal, 2-on-1, I guess. I mean, what are you going to do on a 2-on-1? But you'd like to take away the pass. He didn't. So you can point the finger at Morgan Riley, certainly on allowing the 2-on-1 on the power play. But Jake Gardner looked pretty brutal on the first goal. And there are reports that he will be the odd man out tonight because Roman Polak back in. Corbinian Holzer was the man in the press box on Thursday. What do we make of him? I mean, he got the big deal. He's not going anywhere. There was so much. The expectations were lofty, and I was among those that was kind of scratching my head when Randy Carlisle scratched him early this season, thought that I hadn't seen enough to warrant him being in the press box. And I wouldn't say that that's, you know, it's killed his confidence or anything. I think he's a deserving recipient of a scratch today if he ends up in the press box. And this is a guy with all kinds of talent, but is he ever going to be that you know, top four defenseman on this team, Gare?
It feels like he's heading the other direction.
Right?
You know, it feels like his game has gone backwards in a year and a half, 2 years. You know, when he was breaking through a couple of years back, you're thinking, geez, this is a potential franchise changer, you know, a Carlson-like player. And, boy, he's looking like anything but that at this point. I mean, it has to be a huge disappointment. And, like, money that they would love to get back.
To sign Cody Franzen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so frustrating with guys like that, too, because you see Jake Gardner do things that so many players just can't do. I mean, the way he can move, he's just such a fast skater, and he gets around the ice so well. But yeah, I mean, the thing with someone like Jake is you'd be willing to live with some mistakes. It's just the catastrophes that you can have. And, you know, I think they'd be willing to suck it up if once in a while, because he pushes the play a lot, you know, he's going to turn the puck over here or there. But it's the ones where you look at and you think, what are you thinking? You can't have those at the NHL level. And yes, right now it looks like he's going the wrong way. So.
Yeah, and we'll have to see if he is the odd man out, but a lot of people speculating that he could get another rest tonight as the Flyers come to town. So after that game on Thursday, and we mentioned it's kind of a repeating thing with this team, and the theme that's coming out post-game from games like that Carolina game in the first period, what, they give up 16, 17 shots on goal. They get outworked in that first period, and they're up front. Oh, we got outworked in that first period to the NHL's worst team. And it's hard to argue that point. And maybe they'd been outworked a whole bunch during this current run and even the 6-game winning streak, right? Again, back-to-back in Detroit. So maybe that was part of the reason why they were absolutely obliterated on the shot totals front. But we just kind of understood that the pressure was off of Randy Carlisle after they went on this incredible run. How much can we point to coaching in looking at the shot totals and the fact that they aren't really still carrying the play? There have been games, right? And you can't always point to the shot totals, but I think for the most part, I would even say the majority of the games during that incredible 10-1-1 run, I would say more than half of them, they didn't carry the play, but were still winning because they convert their chances so often. Where does coaching come down in all of this? Because it seems that Randy Carlisle's not pleased, and nor should he be, knowing what happened at the tail end of last season. But he's just, for whatever reason, he can't change the style of play with this team.
I don't put it on coaching. I really don't. I put it on the players, and the players are what they are. This is the team that Randy Carlisle has to work with. You know what? I don't think that he's drawing up X's and O's on the board saying, like, let's let them have the puck for 45 seconds in a shift. I don't think that that's his game plan. You know, so I don't know that you can put it on him. He'd love to see the Leafs cycling the puck for that.
So there's not a coach that can be airlifted in here and change the style of play?
I don't think so. I don't see that for a second. You'd have to, you know, reshuffle the deck and redeal the cards.
It's not somebody that's going to bring in a whip or like a taser or something. Taser would be good.
Well, if anything can get results.
Taser. Don't tase me, bro.
It's really tough with coaching because, you know, you hear from, well, I mean, obviously the guy who used to run this team, Brian Burke, you know, would say that was the most important decision a GM could make. But it, you know, from the outside perspective, I have to say it's a bit hazy, right? Because as Gare says, it's hard to believe. I mean, even look at the Oilers, and I know we'll get to that later, but do you really think the problem in Edmonton the last year and a half was Dallas Eakins was telling guys to stand in the wrong place? Like, I have a hard time buying that. So while I certainly acknowledge that the nature of coaching is changing and more you've got to be instructive and, you know, to some degree, I don't want to say players have to like you, but there is a bit more of a relationship there. Whereas once upon a time, it could just be you come in, you're the dictator, you tell them what to do, you put the fear of God of them or whatever. You know, those times have changed, but
could Scotty Bowman exist in this NHL?
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, he's always so good at mind games. He would still find a way, but yeah,
He had great players to work with.
Well, yeah.
Didn't win in Buffalo. Don't
I got to believe on. One of us could have coached the late 70s Habs to one cup anyways, you know? So,
yeah. It's an interesting conversation because part of it is, yeah, the style of play I think people look at and effort level I think people put on the coaching. But part of it is also development of younger players. And I think as Jake Gardner has gone in reverse, really has developed Nazem Kadri. So don't we have to give Randy Carlyle some sort of credit for that? Because you want to talk about mind games. Maybe there was some of that going on in previous years with Kadri and some people were upset at the way he was treated on this team. But whatever, it's worked apparently because he has turned into that whatever, if you want to call him quote-unquote number one center in the National Hockey League. So I guess Randy's got to get some sort of credit when it comes to Nazem Kadri.
Haters are going to hate.
Yeah, it's true. Like, maybe Dallas Eakins gets some credit, too. Mentioned putting down the potato chips.
He could use the love right now.
Yeah, he could use.
But, you know what? Carlisle will get criticized for Jake Gardner for puck possession. He's going to get no credit on Kadri. You know, haters are going to hate. That's just the way it is.
Part of this Leafs season as well. We mentioned they play in the Eastern Conference, which is just like it seems like every league, the East is far inferior to the Western Conference. And they'll get a dose of the West coming up in January as they go on their annual California trip into LA, Anaheim, San Jose, and then they go to St. Louis as well, January 12th to 17th. That'll be a good test. But they've actually beaten some good teams this year, right? And some Western Conference opponents. Now it's come on home ice, beat the Ducks in a game, and again, that's they do it. They beat them the Maple Leafs way by getting outshot by like a 10-1 margin. Same thing with their win over the Blackhawks at home, where James Reimer absolutely stole them that game. They've actually gone 5-7-1 against sub 500 teams this season, and maybe that was another example of why it was playing according to script on Thursday. Because there you go, NHL's worst team. They did it again. In Buffalo against the Sabres. I keep wanting to bring it back to coaching, but wouldn't that, if you were going to talk about something that coaching should affect, shouldn't it be getting your team in the right mind space to not fall into the trap of playing the NHL's worst team, coming off a 6-game winning streak and believing your own press clippings? Shouldn't that be one of the coach's responsibilities to make sure you don't fall on your face against New Jersey, against Carolina, the last two losses this Maple Leafs team has suffered?
I would be inclined to put it on players more than coaching, right? I think that you're well paid. You should buy in, right?
Like, yeah.
I mean, I don't see that Randy Carlyle has to get the Leafs up to play.
So is it just an anomaly then that they stink against stinky teams?
Well, and also don't forget the stink at the bottom isn't what it once was. Like, the, you know, there's really, especially the way, you know,
oh,
Buffalo,
come on. Carolina stunk headed into that game. There was four straight games. They'd scored one goal in each game.
Yeah, sure. But I'm telling you, I mean, even at the bottom of the barrel, you get a team on home ice that's lost five in a row, it's going to be motivated and a little mad, and they're going to come out and probably have a pretty good first 20 minutes. So if you don't get every save in that first 20 minutes when you're probably going to get outshot 12-7, then all of a sudden the home team has a lead, and they're off to the races a little bit. So
yeah, sorry, it was six straight games. They'd scored exactly one goal headed into that Leaf game, and then they scored one at even strength, power play, shorthanded, and into an empty net. All right, so the big picture thing, and I think this is what I was asking last week too, and it's still a very, very much in people's minds, and we mentioned the trapdoor, other shoe falling, whatever. It's going back to last season, right? And what is the difference between this Leafs team and the team of a year ago? Because on paper, you look at the numbers, you look at the record, man, it's pretty similar to how things were shaping up last year. You've even got that Carolina, I mentioned the Carolina road trip coming up where Jonathan Bernier got injured and the season completely fell apart. So you could see the script headed towards that direction again this year. Why is this year different than last? Or is it? I'll say my piece before I pass it off to you guys. It's different for a couple of reasons. One is that this team actually has four lines, despite the fact that, yes, the shot differential's very similar to last year, whereas last year you couldn't play that fourth line. It was just unplayable, not a real hockey line. And Jonathan Bernier's healthy, and it's not an Olympic year, so you don't have JVR and Phil Kessel going away to Sochi and maybe not having their legs for the rest of the season. For that reason, I think maybe you can continue to sustain this getting outshot by a ton and maybe not win the Eastern Conference or anything, and certainly not go on runs of 10-1-1, but you should be able to make the playoffs. Am I wrong? Am I right?
I think they're making the playoffs. I don't know that they're making a splash in the playoffs, but I think
it's the Eastern Conference, all right?
It is. I think there are some promising signs, you know, casting forward. You know, if we're doing, I don't know if it's a big picture or a satellite photo or whatever we're doing. I mean, but
we're getting in our drone.
Yeah. But it's fragile. Like, it definitely is fragile. It's probably as fragile as, Bernier's groin. Like, we just, if there is one injury, you know, in a very bad place, that could really knock this team down.
But isn't this team have more depth than any team in Leafs recent memory? Like, can't they? They've already sustained injuries to Joffrey Lupul and Roman Polak, who was up there in ice time when they got injured, did pretty well without both of them. Mm-hmm. Isn't this team built to sustain like one or two injuries? Unless it's a goaltender, of course.
If it's a goaltender, it's bad news. And I mean, it's not just recent history with Bernier, but I think that was always one of the concerns when he was in L.A. Right, and when he was in junior, you know,
that could he play 60 plus games?
Yeah,
and I guess that's a big question. And plus, he's got that bugaboo of going to California. I wonder if they wrap him in bubble wrap and don't even bring him on that trip to California this year, Ryan.
Just tap Reimer for three straight. Yeah, make him the starter for a week.
That is the one place where the coach has impact is on goaltender rotation.
Well, do we give him credit for that because he has turned?
I think he's playing with fire.
Like starting him as often as he has?
Yes. Yes.
But he's picking his spots pretty well, it seems like. You know, he taps James Reimer in that back end of back-to-backs against the Detroit Red Wings, and he comes up with a 10 trillion save performance in a 2-1 shootout win. And he's also turned Jonathan Bernier into the number one, and it's kind of happened organically.
And speaking of the, you know, the all-encompassing trepidation that is always around this team, I do think, as well as Reimer has played the last couple times we've seen him, I still think there's a little hesitancy there, which is leading to what Gare is saying in that, you know, maybe they're playing Bernier a little more than you would ideally, but I feel like there's still not a huge amount of faith in Reimer long-term, despite the fact that he has looked, you know, pretty strong the last couple times he's been on the ice.
They don't deal him? I mean, there are teams that could use a goaltender like
him. The problem is he's more valuable to you as a guy who's doing what he's doing for you right now, you know?
An outstanding backup.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're not going, there's no team out there that's going to say, all right, let's trade for James Reimer and solve our goaltending problem, right? So
he's not fooling anybody?
You're not going to get a significant return, and now all of a sudden you've opened yourself up to, well, now you're definitely in a world of trouble if your big guy goes down.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting to see how they do, firstly, on this 7-game road trip, and then looking forward to January going out to California. But so far, so good, and I think the Maple Leafs, the recent play, probably earning a bit of a mulligan on Thursday against the Hurricanes. When we come back, talking about the Oilers and Dallas Eakins and giving him a little credit for Nazem Kadri, and he needs the love right now. I don't know if he does. He gets to get paid for 2 years to do nothing. All right? That's not so bad. We'll talk about Dallas Eakins getting fired out in Edmonton. The Oilers still unable to win without him, and Craig McTavish and what's gone on in Edmonton. And now these rumors of Taylor Hall being on the move and the Calgary Flames locking up Bob Hartley. And they haven't won since that happened. They hadn't won in the previous six before they did it as well. And probably talk about the Montreal Canadiens as well. Get Ryan's perspective on Alex Galchenyuk as a centerman. Now, this is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gare Joyce and Ryan Dixon on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Martin Zwelling.
The Detroit Lions call it free hurt. It's the defensive mantra that says no quarterback can be comfortable in the pocket, and any ball carrier who dares to run up the middle can expect plenty of pain, free of charge. It's why the Lions have the best run defense in the NFL.
This team has been known as an offensive team, but you know now, you know, things are going to change. We're going to be known for our defense. You know, we know what we have on the side of the ball, and that's really been our mentality is, you know, you can buy whatever you want, but, you know, against this team, you know, hurt comes for free.
Over their first 14 games, the Lions have allowed less than 65 rushing yards per contest, by far the lowest in the league and the fifth lowest mark in NFL history. You simply have to throw the ball against this team. And that's when elite pass rushers like Ndamukong Suh, Ezekiel Ansah, and Nick Fairley go to work.
No one can stop us if we do our technique and assignments correct. No one can score on us. No one can run the ball. No one can pass the ball. It's up to us. We make teams, basically, as a defense, we try to make them go on all turns.
The cast of characters that make up the best defensive line in the NFL.
Fans can find this story and more on Sportsnet.ca. Canada's home for sports news, analysis, videos, and features.
Happy Saturday to you, Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Gare Joyce and Ryan Dixon. The Edmonton Oilers have a new head coach. Doesn't seem to matter. They've lost, 17 of the last 18 now? Six straight? Dallas Eakins canned earlier this week. They are back to being the worst team in the National Hockey League thanks to the Toronto Maple Leafs, who lose to the Carolina Hurricanes on Thursday. Now rumors that, yes, one of those young guns is going to be on the move, and maybe that's Taylor Hall, who appears to be one of the better ones. I don't know if that's the move. I don't know if firing the head coach was the move. I mean, it was the move because it was the move they made. But certainly you can't put it on Dallas Eakins as one of the sole reasons why the Edmonton Oilers are 7-20-6. Maybe part of the reason. But, guys, we were just talking during the break about the goaltending situation and the numbers for the two goalies in Edmonton. I know it's, you know, shot quality is part of it as well, but the save percentage numbers for Ben Scrivens and Victor Faust are just god awful. Horrible.
Did anyone really think of Ben Scrivens as a number one goaltender?
Maybe they did when he made that, like, he had 60 saves, against the Sharks last year, yeah. Remember?
Yeah, he had a good run with LA,
one shining
right?
Moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. But how much can we put on the goaltending situation?
Oh, I think a bit.
You know what? There are only two guys who are bulletproof in that organization, and they're the problem. Lowe and McTavish are the problems. And now they're in charge of finding solutions. And, you know, they created this mess. It's on them. when McTavish said there's blood on my hands, I mean, actually, there's blood. You're soaked in blood, right? Like it's everywhere. It's a disaster, and it's a cascade of bad decisions. You know, I look at Dreisaitl being rushed in. I talked to Dreisaitl at the combine. He said he had no illusions about playing in the league this year. He said he was clearly not ready back in junior.
How many prospects say that? How often do guys say, you know what, I'd like to be in the NHL, but I don't think I'm ready? I mean, that doesn't seem like it happens all that often.
No, and you know, and that's not a knock on the kid. That's just
I think it's refreshingly like realistic.
Yeah. But you know, Edmonton knows better than the kid.
They beg to differ.
Yeah. So I mean, wherever it is like that episode of Seinfeld, right? If you want to figure out what would be the best thing to do, go absolutely the
opposite.
The opposite way.
Which has to be the most terrifying thing for Oilers fans, right? It's like you've lived through all this already, and there's no assurance that someone else is going to start making the decisions.
Yeah.
What's it going to take for Craig McTavish to get fired? I mean, this is a guy who was fired as the head coach, hired on, and then hired himself as the head coach again. I mean, what is it going to take for that country club atmosphere to subside? It's going to come from on high, I guess, but is there any indication that something like that could happen?
A stake through the heart.
Yeah.
I think that's the only thing that gets him out of there. I mean, he's enjoyed, you know, so many lives at this point. And I think that it's ownership driven, it's upper management driven, and those guys aren't going anywhere. I feel for whoever goes in there next, and you know, whoever gets traded out of there should be throwing a party.
I mean, it's crazy to think, too, that there's so many bright hockey minds out there right now. Like, you look at somebody like Ray Shiro, who, I mean, I think you could certainly argue, while there was only the one cup, did some great things in Pittsburgh. And, you know, there's guys working in organizations whose, you know, names aren't very prominent yet. But, you know, you hand them the reins to that team with the raw materials that are still there, and you have to think that it wouldn't take that much when you throw in possibly a generational player, almost certainly a generational player this year, whether it's Eichel or Connor McDavid. Man, if you got someone in charge who is finding the odd third round gem, then you've got something really cooking there. But it just doesn't, you know, as we've said, there's no indication that Cates is going to do anything other than leave it in the hands of the people he apparently worshipped in their playing days.
Yeah. With the Oilers, one of the other things is that there is always turnover on scouting staffs around the league. Edmonton's no. And you know what? They've had great picks to work with, and it's hard not to hit on a number one pick.
But there was not a lot of dissension on, you know, from the general public when there was a bunch of obvious picks, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could have.
But they found nothing outside of
right.
That.
Right. It's been the picks outside of the number ones overall, right?
Yeah. I mean, the only value that they've really got outside of you know, those picks in the, you know, top five, you know, and so many first overalls, but it was Justin Schultz. Right.
Yeah.
And that's a free agent signing. Like, you know, I mean, that's the only young player that they've been able to procure, you know, outside of that, you know, that podium pick.
Yeah. It's not been good. Nail Yakubov, don't even want to, begin to talk about how disappointing his, NHL career has been. Before we move on to some of the other teams, Dallas Eakins back in the NHL. I don't know. Does he have to go back to the AHL? What's his career path? Has this really, you know, put a stain on his resume? I guess how could it not? But again, what is he working with?
He's going to get the job that he was applying for last time. It'll be an NHL assistant.
Yeah,
you know, and that's what he was interviewing for in Edmonton. And I mean, that's just like the brain lock that these guys are in. You know, interviewing for an assistant, interviewing a candidate as an assistant and handing him the head job. You know, it is absolute screw loose management.
Yeah, I would think, you know, as Gare said there, you know, obviously Akins was a bit of a golden boy, kind of similar to Guy Boucher, I guess, when he joined Tampa a few years back, where even though he hadn't been an NHL coach, it seemed like he was being wooed by a few. You know, some of the shine I would imagine came off, but I have to believe that, yes, he's going to land back in hockey and, you know, step by step, probably work his way eventually back up to a top job.
So things aren't going all that well in Alberta as a whole. As the Flames now dropping out of a playoff spot. They were the surprise of the National Hockey League not so long ago, but they've lost seven straight. Hasn't seemed to matter too much to the front office there, as they have re-signed Bob Hartley to a multi-year extension, guys. So, I mean, expectations change on the fly, and I guess they had a little bit with the Flames that are on the outside looking into the playoff picture in the Western Conference. 2 points back of the Kings for that second wild card spot. But as I mentioned, losers of seven straight. Got a pretty good number one D pair and some pretty good pieces. But I don't know. Do we expect them to get back into that wild? Have they already shot their bolt this season, now 34 games into it?
I called for them to be the last overall. I have no hope of that happening. Yeah. But
that would be tough.
Yeah, not doable. You know, they can. Calgary can cooperate, but I think, you know, being 16 points ahead of Edmonton.
Although, is Edmonton going to win 9 more games this year? I don't know.
I can't see it. Just can't see it. But Calgary, the free fall is inexorable at this point. Reasons for promise, I think there are a few there, you know, and like you say, a great pair in Giordano and Brody. You know, give them points on that. It looks like they hit at least a gapper, maybe a double on Goudreau, you know, a great later round pick. I don't know. I don't see it turning around anytime fast. It looked fragile from the get-go for me.
Yeah, I definitely thought they were going to be near the bottom as well, no question. And I will admit to getting sucked in a little bit by their start. And I'm still, I mean, they're the free falling right now. But I still wouldn't be surprised if they kind of punch around a 500 level the rest of the way because of that top pair. And
goaltending as well.
Yeah, I mean, Hiller and Romo have been pretty good. And, you know, I would say that, I mean, for years, I bashed on Calgary and you know, was part of a chorus for sort of being, I mean, they were actually kind of giving the Oilers a run for being, I don't know about dysfunctional, but willful blindness was the approach in Calgary for all those years that things were slowly deteriorating. It seemed like they were hanging on to the luster of almost winning the Stanley Cup in 2004 for so long, and they held on, you know, the Craig Conroy's and Damon Lankow's of the world, who, you know, it was clearly time to turn over a new leaf, and it took too long. However, they have picked high the last couple years and got Bennett and Monahan as two guys who, for the next 10 years, you might run out there as your 1-2 center and feel pretty good about. You know, they find a guy like TJ Brody, and I think the third round, we mentioned Goudreau. If a couple of the other guys that they've drafted in the last couple years, when they have started the rebuilding process, hit the way, you know, not even the way Brody has, but even, you know, close to that, I can see a framework there. So I do think that I'm as surprised as anyone, because it really seemed like they just dragged their heels for far too long. But, you know, obviously the way they were playing up until 2 weeks ago, I think everyone agreed that to some degree things were going to slow down. I don't necessarily think that now the bottom's going to completely fall out and they're going to be revealed for the completely terrible team that they are, and you know, and that it's going to take them forever to get back on track.
Yeah. Did you see Glenn Cross being a top two line player? Like there's a whole bunch of those question marks there.
Yeah.
You know, can you lean on a 19-year-old or, you know, barely 20-year-old like Monahan as like your go-to guy?
Long-term, like, tough over the course of a full season.
I don't
think
it's sustainable.
Yeah, and maybe having another high draft pick, probably the best thing for their development. Quickly, Montreal Canadiens, Alex Galchenyuk, now number one center. Early returns, pretty good on that, Ryan.
Yeah, it's the sort of the move they've been talking about since Galchenyuk came into their organization. This is his third year in the league now, and the Canadians were, you know, they're bringing him along slowly, putting him on the wing because they did kind of have a bit of a logjam at center. But, you know, all along there were sort of questions about, you know, this is the guy who you want to, you know, you drafted third overall, you want to build around. Why not get him in the middle? They had a tough stretch there a couple of weeks ago, lost 6-7, decided to really put things in a blender. They put Galchenyuk in the middle. And, yeah, so far he's looked looked right at home. He's done well on faceoffs, had some chemistry with Max Pacioretty, who is, I think, day-to-day right now after he went hard into the boards in their last game.
He's like a crash test dummy.
Yeah, you know? Like, always bounces
it's
back.
It's crazy what he has to go through.
It's true. But, yeah, I think Galchenyuk definitely has Canadians fans dreaming of something they haven't had for a long time, which is a pretty big guy, and he's got some real talent, and I think someone who can really actually, you know, move the needle offensively in the top spot in the middle there.
The Canadian World Juniors looking to do something they haven't done in a long time. That's win a gold medal, as they will open up their tournament on Boxing Day. Opened up their exhibition schedule yesterday with 2-1 overtime loss to Russia. We'll talk about the Canadian World Junior team and final cuts being made, and Connor McDavid going to play in his first game tomorrow in Ottawa against Sweden. That's coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gare Joyce and Ryan Dixon on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gare Joyce and Ryan Dixon. It is December and holiday season, so that means World Junior time just around the corner. Boxing Day is when Team Canada gets underway in Montreal against Slovakia. Gare, you're going to be there. It's always fun going to Montreal, right? Any excuse.
Absolutely.
So World Juniors played their first exhibition game yesterday down at Air Canada Centre, and they lost 2-1 in overtime to Russia despite throwing 50-plus shots on goal. Didn't have some of their best players as well. Curtis Lazar, Connor McDavid not in the lineup yesterday. Gare, is there much to make out of yesterday's game? 50 shots is pretty good. Results obviously don't matter in an exhibition game. What did you make of that game? And then the cuts, the final cuts also coming down the pipe as Michael Dell Cole, first round pick of the Islanders, did not make this team.
Yeah, that one was a bolt of lightning out of the clear blue sky for a lot of people. And I like him as a player, but you know what? They have that guy, you know, they have those players. He certainly would have been on the team if the Rangers aren't releasing Duclair back to the team, if Ottawa is not releasing Lazar, Dell Cole would have been there for sure. But they've got a glut of talent, I think, you know, for top two lines, for two offensive lines on this team. They've got nine guys competing for that. And I don't know that you could cast Dell Cole in a third line position or, you know, a fourth line guy. I don't know that he would really thrive or do you a lot of service in a role like that.
I think a lot of people are looking at this team and the way last year's team just couldn't finish, couldn't really score, and reason why they finished out of the medals, Finland winning last year's tournament. They haven't won a gold since 2009, and wondering if Canada is going back to just sending the highest skilled players to this tournament, because the Canadian senior team got into the habit of, oh, we'll build a team. We'll have, like, the best grinders. We'll have the best third line in the world.
Chris Draper.
Yeah. And they sent him to Turin, and that blew up spectacularly. Yeah. Finally got back to sending the best players in the world to the Olympics. And have they kind of figured that out at the junior level this year, Gare?
You know, I think they got away forcing fits like that over the years. You know, like certainly back in the...
Was that not part of the problem though last year? Or was it just not that skilled a team?
I would say that if you have Connor McDavid at 16 as one of your first or second centers, that's an indictment of the skill level that they had to work with, you know? So, and I mean, not just him, they had Reinhardt as an underager on that team as well, or a draft eligible player. Like, you know what? In the old days, they would say it's a 19-year-old's tournament. And for a draft eligible kid, Joe Thornton was a 13th forward, you know, on a winning team. They've gone away from it, I think, less from the role playing, you know, the role filling. I think they've gone away from the idea that actually it's a 19-year-old's tournament. That's what they've stepped away from.
And they've got some guys with some NHL experience on this team. You mentioned Anthony Duclair. Curtis Lazar did not play in yesterday's game, but Duclair, what I've seen a little bit from him this season when Maple Leafs went to Madison Square Garden, he looked like he had incredible wheels. Played on the top line yesterday with Reinhardt and Max Domi. Domi is an interesting guy, and people, of course, look at the name on the back of the jersey, and there was a couple of stories written about him playing at the Air Canada Center for the first time, and he was pretty excited to do that, and Ty's kid and all that. How good are these kids for people who don't follow junior hockey, and Max Domi and Anthony Duclair?
Domi is a crazy-ass creative player.
Yeah.
Like, he has great vision.
So nothing like his dad.
No. No, and better looking. Right? And Ty's a spectacular.
But the square head, there's no question that Max is Ty's son.
No, well... I wouldn't go there on that. I think he takes after mom myself, but
I just
Max,
the,
I have all kinds
head shape.
Of time. Yeah.
He's got the same head shape.
I give Max all kinds of points. He's a real talent. He's a very nice kid. He is not his father's son when it comes to skill set and things like that. Just a different animal, but I thought he should have been on last year's team too. And I think they really tried to get him working with McDavid in the Subway Series, and it just he didn't have a good Subway Series, and that sort of killed his chances last year. I think it was a mistake, but he gets a shot at it now.
What about the fact that McDavid has not played yet in an exhibition game and hasn't played in a long time with the broken wrist? He's been out for a while. And he's kind of done some non-contact stuff and skated with this team, but he'll get into his first game action tomorrow in Ottawa, as I mentioned, against Sweden and William Nylander's team. But is it necessary for him to play some games? I mean, there's going to be a little bit of rust, you would think, Gare, that it's been so long since Connor McDavid's actually played in a game to get back to speed.
I think he can figure it out. I am reasonably confident in his ability. He'll be able to figure it out if he.
What's going on with his hair? Like every time I see him, like is he actively trying to do that, or is it like I don't care what's going on with my hair?
There is a sort of goofy aspect to him. I think he plays on it somewhat.
It's a good reminder that they're still goofy kids too, right?
Yeah, like, yes. That's the thing. And I think everybody's looking forward to seeing him and Jack Eichel and facing off against each other. It was kind of interesting hearing that he's never actually met Jack Eichel before as well.
Yeah. No, I talked to Eichel a week or so back, and that did come up, and he said, you know, like at least every day and sometimes every hour, someone will say McDavid, you know, just the name will pop out of the blue, and he'll do the head snap. And it is this sort of recurring nightmare, recurring dream that he hears this name all the time of someone that he hasn't met. And you know what, whenever we have these, you know, it's McDavid versus Eichel. They'll probably be on the ice against each other for 2 or 3 minutes. They're not, there are no head to heads. I was going to say, I remember I was sent to do a story. It was the last meeting of Gretzky and Lemieux, when Mario was retiring, and it was supposed to be head to head. They were on the ice for 4 seconds together, right? One was coming on, one was coming off. I mean, that's how these things work.
Finally, there we go.
The Bradulina of the 2015 draft.
Yeah, the McDavid Eichel deal. I just don't think is going to be quite the head to head that people think it's going to be.
Have you seen much of Eichel? Because he's a mystery to a lot of people, right? Obviously, not playing in the CHL, playing with the U.S. developmental team and Boston University and whatever. Have you seen much of him at all?
I've seen video. I've seen video
of that 12-year-old Japanese kid too.
Yeah. No, I watched a couple of games, a couple of BU games, and he's a man. Like that, I think that's the real difference between McDavid and Eichel, is that Eichel is a fleshed out franchise center. Big body, certainly not the speed that McDavid has. But he'll be a physical force in an under 20 tournament, because he's a physical force playing against 23-year-olds.
Yeah. Well, where is the level of competition when you're talking about NCAA hockey compared to the CHL? Obviously age is part of it. So you got, I guess more mature players, but the level of competition can't be near what it is in the CHL, or is it?
I think, this is a tough one. I would say that the physical challenge playing in the NC2A it's a lot more demanding, in game situations. You're just dealing with bigger guys. There are no 16-year-olds out there. So matchups can be a lot harder. And believe me, every team is trying to stop Eichel with their best player. And they're the top ranked team, or we're the top ranked team in the NC2A. And Eichel has a target on him. And you know what? He survives against a lot bigger players than he'll see in Montreal and Toronto.
And if Connor McDavid was playing in the NCAA, he would have still been playing for the last month, because he would have gotten into a fight. There would have been no impetus for that. But he doesn't, and he is. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Gare Joyce and Ryan Dixon. So mentioned the recent futility of this Canadian junior team. They haven't won a gold medal since 2009. And this is the only country you can really say that that's a run of futility, not winning a gold medal. But they haven't medaled at all the last couple of years. Tournaments in Malmo and then in Ufa, Russia, the last couple of years. But back in Canada, they did medal when it was in Calgary and Edmonton in 2012. Does the fact that it's back here in Canada and in Toronto and Montreal, and I guess the finals are going to be here, but Canada's going to play the round-robin games in Montreal, does that set up well for this Canadian team? Is it because you talk about pressure being an issue with younger players, and maybe it was in that final against Russia in Buffalo, where things collapsed.
Oh my God!
In the third period, and Dave Cameron, Mark Vizintin, and that whole thing. Where does that factor in, the fact that this is on home ice this year, Gare?
I think it's not a matter of it being on home ice. I think that there'll be a level of comfort playing on the North American ice surface rather than the bigger international sheet. Good teams figure it out. But I think it's a comfort level for the Canadian team, and it's a change. It's an adaptation that Russia and Sweden will have to make. That's advantage Canada, I think. But it can go sideways quick when you're talking about Buffalo. I was just expecting the masks to drop from the ceiling. Like it just felt like the entire arena was depressurized, right?
That was unbelievable that night. And Mark Vizantin and Dave Cameron. It does. It kind of gets lodged into your memory, right?
Oh my God, that was the worst one ever. And I mean, that's sort of the one that started the ball rolling. I remember we were voting on tournament all-stars, you know, in the third period. We've got Shen there, and oh my God, it was a tough one. But you know, maybe this tournament's going to play out like it did in Ottawa. The last time that they won, it was sort of on this hockey axis. And I do like a lot of the talent on the Canadian team. But the one thing I'd say, I say there's a comfort level for the Canadian team. By the time you get to the final, if you're playing a European team, they've played enough together on a small sheet that they'll be comfortable too.
Who do we look at as the favorites? Is it Canada, Gary? Because we know there's so much talent elsewhere, and Nylander on Sweden, and Russia's got a pretty good team despite being outshot by 30 yesterday in an exhibition tournament, and Jack Eichel on the U.S. team. Who do you look at it as being the favorites this year? And Finland, of course, won it last year.
Yeah. It sounds like a cop-out, but I don't think that there's much to choose between them going in. I don't know that anyone goes in as a prohibitive favorite. You know, if I had to throw a dollar down on someone, I would probably go with Sweden, just because they seem to have come up with a formula for putting together good teams, you know, getting their teams ready to play in this tournament. Not necessarily the most talent to work with all the time, but it's not always the most talent that wins.
Yeah, it's certainly the case in the last few years, to be sure, in Canada, looking for its first gold since 2009. When we come back, Raptors with another win over a sub-500 team yesterday as they hold on for a 10-point win over the Detroit Pistons. It's going to get a little tougher after tomorrow when they host the New York Knicks, and then they will head out on the road. Very tough stretch of games. And they have a new logo as well. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. And Blue Jays, still looking to fill some holes that they were looking to fill at the beginning of the offseason. They've filled some holes that maybe didn't need filling. And the Padres going absolutely berserk this offseason, picking up Justin Upton to throw into an outfield with Matt Kemp as well. That's all coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Gare Joyce on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Ryan Dixon.
Look around the NHL right now and you'll quickly find a young group of stars toe-dragging their way to the top. If there's a poster boy for this flashy mob, it's the inked-up Tyler Seguin. The Dallas Stars sniper exudes self-assurance, likely due to the fact he can beat opponents in every way imaginable. Seguin may lead the next wave of wildly talented players, but he's by no means alone. The St. Louis Blues have finally found a game-breaker in Vladimir Tarasenko, while Nashville's all-around force Philip Forsberg is the leading candidate for Rookie of the Year. In Florida, Big Nick Bjugstad is using his deadly shot to inflict damage, something he's been doing since his youngest days growing up in Minnesota.
Broke a few windows. I think that's pretty standard for any player, but yeah, they'd go through, they'd hit the house, you could see. I think my mom kind of gave up. She kind of just accepted the fact that the house was going to take a beating.
At the other end of the size spectrum, little Johnny Gaudreau is justifying the faith former Calgary Flames GM Jay Feaster had in director of amateur scouting Todd Button at the 2011 draft.
Todd felt very, very strongly about it, and you know, he kept saying, I know he's not very big. He said, but I'm telling you, this kid can play, and he's the most exciting player that we've seen.
Take your eyes off these guys for a minute, and you're liable to miss something brilliant. And in the case of NHL defensemen, lose sight of them for even a second, and you're bound to be embarrassed.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Gare Joyce, taking you through until 12 o'clock, and then I've got an edition of Sportsnet Today before Hockey Nation at 5 o'clock, Leafs and Philadelphia Flyers from the Air Canada Center. Raptors yesterday, taking care of business as they are wont to do. Their fifth straight game against a sub 500 opponent and their fifth straight win against such teams, 110-100 in Detroit. And guys, I was struck by how many Raptor fans were in Detroit. And obviously, it's a quick little trip down the 401 there. We saw so many Raptor fans in Cleveland the couple of times they've played the Cavaliers. And getting an indication from people who've been around the team and were around the team during the Vince Carter glory years, even then it was not anywhere near to what's gone on as far as fan support for this team. We know what they're like at home. The playoffs was ridiculous. Regular season games, Drake night, whatever. It's become one of the toughest tickets in town. It's right up there with the Maple Leafs, honestly. That's not an exaggeration to say. And maybe road support better for this team than it is for the Maple Leafs, although maybe that's jumping the gun a little bit because we know how many Leafs show up in Buffalo whenever they play the Sabres. But it's been pretty remarkable thing to watch.
Yeah, and the rep is spreading league-wide, right? I mean, you kind of hear people referencing it and, yeah, kind of busting some of those Canadian stereotypes, too, of being the, you know, the quiet, staid fans. They really were rocking it in Detroit. I saw they were singing the national anthem and ended up on the court even, I think, for a big group photo. Masai Ujiri made a little guest spot on one of the buses, too, so I think he's... I mean, talk about a guy who's really endeared himself to the fan base, including his salty language. You know, he's been a great face for the franchise, and there's a lot of faces, a lot of painted faces that are, you know, really, really showing strong support across the board for the Raps.
It does evoke the late 80s, early 90s Blue Jays. You know, the sort of cachet that this team has in this market right now. You know, I remember people traveling to Cleveland to go see the Jays, and I mean, there would be no crowd but for the Toronto fans. You know, it's a fun team to watch. Last night, you just never, when they're down 8 points in the second quarter, you thought, there's no way they're losing this game, right? Like they are the it's not that they're clutch. It's just that they feel sort of inevitable and they overachieve so consistently that it has to stop being overachieving. And just that we're sort of underrating or underestimating them. I think what's their magic number in the Atlantic is 3 now or something like that. It's crazy.
Yeah. The Atlantic stinks and yeah,
it's terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible. And the Eastern Conference as a whole, I don't want to say the Eastern Conference is terrible because there's some good teams. Washington's good, I think. Atlanta's good, and we know Cleveland's pretty good, and so are the Chicago Bulls. But outside of that, you got a lot of blah. And the Raptors have played the blah last 5 games. I mentioned the sub-500 teams, and they get another one on Sunday before getting, a real good test. But it's, you know, you can't beat those crappy teams all the time. The Raptors have. They have just one loss against a team that is currently under 500. They beat the Cavaliers, or they lost to the Cavaliers when they were under 500, I believe. But their one loss to a sub-500 team was the Lakers, that overtime loss in L.A. where Kobe had a triple-double, kind of went out of their minds, went out of his mind, and they had a very good chance to win that game. But, I mean, isn't that kind of the mark of a good team? Isn't it hard to knock a team for beating crappy teams? Because, yeah, mediocre teams lose occasionally to bad teams. This team hasn't. I mean, that's not an overstatement. It's happened once this year, and now we're into late December.
And doing it without one of its stars, right? Yeah. I mean, you really can't ask for much better than that. I think when I was here about a month ago, maybe not quite even, we talked about what would be good for the Raps in the wake of DeMar going down, and you kind of thought, you know, more or less at that point, as long as they could tread water maybe a little better, you would take that while he was gone. And they've been, you know, much better than you could have expected. They've gone well beyond just keeping their head above water. Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic to be able to say you've done that regardless of who you're playing when one of your big boys is on the shelf.
I know that I was going off on you can't pin things on Randy Carlyle or, you know, that he'll get no credit and only blame. But boy, they have to figure out a way to get Casey the Coach of the Year award.
Yeah, that would
be something. He has got 100% buy-in from everyone on this team. You know, there are no unhappy campers. There are roles. Everyone fills one. I mean, maybe Lowry would have become a great player someplace else, but he did it with Casey, right? You know, is there someone who might not be living up completely to his potential? Maybe Valanciunas. There's room there, but at least we've seen a new Terrence Ross.
Yeah, well, and I think Patrick Patterson this season has been a revelation as well. His 3-point shooting, he is number 7 in all of the NBA in 3-point percentage at almost 50%. He's shooting 48% from 3, which is unbelievable. A guy that could be starting, I suppose, and I've even noticed his defense and rebounding being a little bit improved this year. The Raptors seemingly have one of the best second units in all of the NBA, and it allows them to lose a guy like DeMar DeRozan for an extended period of time and not miss too much. But that being said, mentioned they got the Knicks at home on Sunday, then they go on the road. That is going to be murderous. You go Chicago, Clippers, Denver, Portland, Golden State, Phoenix in a road trip that is 6 games in length. I mean, what's a successful 6-game road trip against all those tough teams? And maybe you can, I mean, they've beaten Denver, they've beaten Phoenix already this season. They have not beaten those other clubs this year. Clippers look like it's taken a bit of a step back. Warriors look unbelievable. Portland just beat the Spurs yesterday. I mean, is 2-4 acceptable? Are you, if you're a Raptor fan or if you're Dwayne Casey, are you looking at, you know what, 2-4, we're not going to be ecstatic, but we will take 2-4 because this could be 0-6. I mean, you blink an eye and it could be.
3-3 would be like a lottery win.
Yeah.
You know, like it would be a big ask. You know, 2-4 is realistic, but it might not be that. It just might not be that. They haven't felt the effect of DeRozan's absence to this point.
Yeah,
in any big significant way, this might be where that sort of comes through.
And they fared all right against Western Conference opponents. Now, there's a caveat seemingly with every single one. I mean, they beat the Thunder without Westbrook or Durant. They beat the Grizzlies, one of the better teams in the Western Conference, although they were missing 5 guys with the flu. They've beaten Phoenix. That was a pretty good win, but I think Phoenix was on the tail end of a long road trip there as well. They had a pretty close loss against the Dallas Mavericks, who are now a different team with Rajon Rondo. And even last year, they had some pretty good wins out west on their Western Conference road trip, beat Denver, I believe, and had a close finish at the buzzer against the Trailblazers. But it's going to be a pretty good indication of where this team is when they go out west. Is there going to, if they go, all right, 1-5 or the dreaded 0-6 on this thing, isn't the conversation when they get back, okay, yeah, they're a fine Eastern Conference team, but okay, let's not get ahead of ourselves. If they were in the West, that they might not even be a playoff team. And that's maybe, I don't know if that is fair, but it's going to be a conversation that you can point to as having legitimacy if they go 0-6. Now, again, that's probably a negative way to look at things, and I don't know what the likelihood is of them going 0-6, but there will be people around NBA circles having that conversation if they go winless on this road trip.
I'm sure that will come up in a case like that. But you talk about all these bad things that happen to teams before the Raptors come to town. You know, I fully expect the Warriors to break out in mumps.
Yeah, mumps. They share buildings with these NHL teams, right? Yeah. Although nobody plays in Oakland. No NHL team. Maybe they can get one in there before Raptors go there on January 2nd. The Blue Jays, they've kind of been quiet ever since making their big moves at third base, Josh Donaldson, and at catcher, Russell Martin. Those were two positions they didn't really need to improve on. They did. There's no question they did. But the two question marks going into this offseason remain second base and the bullpen. They've done nothing. And we've seen lots of bullpen arms flying off the shelf. Now, a lot of them flying off the shelf at ridiculous prices. You know, $10 million plus over 4 years for David Robertson, and pretty similar numbers for Andrew Miller and Luke Gregerson, and teams that we're not used to seeing being very active in acquiring players. San Diego Padres, Chicago Cubs. Those are the teams that have been out there doing things, and White Sox as well. We've seen them active in previous years, but recently it's been a sad sack franchise. Where is the hope level for Blue Jays fans this offseason? And still, there is time for things to play out, but it is concerning, I think, the fact that the question marks that you went into this offseason, they still remain for this Blue Jays team.
I don't know how they fill the second base hole.
There's this Japanese kid that they're looking at, Torii Tani.
Oh, man. That's a big wish right there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
trying to project numbers from Japan.
Get the genie from the bottle, right?
Yeah.
You know, I just don't see that one happening. But, you know, what's the best piece that they have to trade? Navarro, right?
Yeah. That's the big domino that has to fall.
But how do you convert that into a second baseman? You know, I'm more concerned about second base than the bullpen.
Really? The bullpen was so bad last year, though.
But I think you can find that in the market. Like, that's a broad need, right? Second base is a specific one. And it's to find a trade partner with, if it's Navarro that you're talking about. Now, if you're going to do Daniel Norris, you know, or something like that, okay, you're going to be able to get something in the market if you're willing to really part with you know, the prize in your cupboard. But they've expended a lot of that already.
Well, I've had this conversation with Mike Wilner in the last couple of weeks, and it's something I have a tough time getting over. Yeah, Blue Jays 1-5 is, I mean, spectacular. How do you get away from Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, and Josh Donaldson? Nobody's going to touch that, I think, in all of baseball. But if you're looking at a 6, 7, 8, 9 of maybe Justin Smoke, Michael Saunders, Meister Asturias, Dalton Pompey, isn't that a concerning way to go into the 2015 season? I mean, relying on that much offense from the middle of your order, wouldn't you like to have at least one more bat in there?
Yeah, I guess they're hoping Saunders has a bit of a, you know, he's shown some glimpses, and I'm sure they've kind of got him penciled in for a few home runs. And I don't know. I guess maybe they're banking on being, you know, extremely strong defensively at some of those positions, I guess, in center and maybe at second base as well, that's where the value comes from. But, yeah, it's, you know, certainly there's as you pointed out, there's a huge difference between the top half and the bottom half, and it's got to be mildly discouraging to have that, you know, a discrepancy of that size.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Gare Joyce. And before I go any further, John Griggs going to yell at me if I don't circle back and talk a little fashion.
Oh.
I forgot to mention that the Raptors have a new logo that looks very much like what's going on with the Brooklyn Nets. And I don't know, you don't need to spend half an hour talking about it, but John or Gare, what are your initial impressions?
I plead color blindness. Right? Fashion stories,
don't re logos,
just does not work for me. I wish they would go to the old Huskies when that throwback.
I think they were going to if this team had imploded last year.
That throwback I could adopt. You know, like something that looks like YMCA from the 1940s. I'm down with, you know, but. I've never, you know what? I hate to say it. I've never liked the Raptors name.
I think it's okay.
Oh, man.
No. I mean, the fact that it's based on a movie and it might not be a real dinosaur. Right.
It's just that Huskies one was right there hanging,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It was so perfect.
Yeah. And that had a good look to it.
Yeah.
And they wore those things.
Yeah. You know, and it does go to sort of a very thin slice of history. The idea that the first NBA game was played at Maple Leaf Gardens, the Knickerbockers versus the Huskies. Like, why go away from that?
Yeah.
But anyways, have we filled the fashion quotient?
Well, we're going to have Jeannie Becker on next hour to talk about it, I think. Yeah. And John Grigg says...
I don't know why John Grigg would be concerned with fashion. He doesn't seem to be concerned with fashion
really?
Every day.
But. Have you not seen what... Oh, my goodness. Yeah. There's maybe not more fashion-prone guy in all the magazine section. Come on.
Prone is
that
a
is
good
a,
word.
That yeah. is a... It's a low bar. Very low bar.
And he says, he tweets me, he never yells. I don't know if that's true. Have to see him in a story meeting. So Sportsnet Magazine Live... Sportsnet Radio Network. Let's get a little NFL here before we wrap it up, before the top of the hour. Story recently with two weeks left in this NFL season and the 49ers being officially eliminated from playoff contention despite a half-decent record at 7-7. The offense has been horrible. They've just been brutal, especially within the division. And Jim Harbaugh, we all expect to be gone at the end of this season. But it's weird to see a head coach so unwanted by his own team, and those are the indications, but so wanted anywhere else. I mean, people are going to fall over themselves to go hire this guy. Now, whether it's across the bay with the Oakland Raiders or whether it's in the NCAA with his alma mater, Michigan Wolverines, someone's going to pay him, close to $10 million a season to coach their team. And it seems like there is a shelf life with this guy. So that being said, Ryan, does Michigan make sense for Jim Harbaugh?
I think it makes sense for Michigan, obviously. And that's quite clear based on the rumored $8 million per year salary that they're going to throw at him that would exceed what Nick Saban's making in Alabama. I think for Michigan, I mean, they're obviously a once proud program that's had some tough times, and I think they gotta, if they can find a way to make this happen, they have to try and make it happen. Does it make sense for Harbaugh? Probably not much. I think it's, going back to the NCAA after you've been in the NFL can be, it's not necessarily the path that for everyone. Obviously Saban has done it and things have worked out well for him, but I don't know. I just love the idea that there is such a spiteful aspect to Jim Harbaugh that he is just eyeing that Raiders job, not just so that he can go over there and stay in the NFL and turn a team around, but so that he can do it in the backyard of the team that apparently doesn't want him. That's got to be the most fun storyline anyways.
I wouldn't... If Harbaugh was trying to recruit my kid, I would slam the door on his foot.
Take your khaki somewhere else.
Yeah. We were talking about it. If you have to be a bad person to be a pro football coach,
yeah,
Jim Harbaugh should be the greatest coach who ever drew breath, right?
Right.
I mean, he is the worst guy in sports. I would wish that he would go to the Raiders. I really would.
Seems like an actual fit for him.
I would hate to do that to young people at a university, right? do it to, he's quite capable of not turning around the Raiders. It'd be fascinating to watch him just fall flat on his face and soil his khakis in Oakland.
It's going to be really fascinating to see what happens with him. And I'm sure we'll hear more and more stories about his tenure in San Francisco when it finally becomes his ex-team, the San Francisco 49ers. Garrett, you were following the Buffalo Bills, and you were at that game.
I was.
Against the Packers, and man,
live to tell.
The Bills are still alive in the AFC, although kind of hanging by a thread, despite being tied with Kansas City and San Diego on record at 8-6. They lose the tiebreaker to both teams because they've lost to both teams this season. Baltimore and Pittsburgh holding down the wild card spots in the AFC. And you look at a defense that shut down Peyton Manning and Aaron Rodgers in consecutive weeks, and you look at what could have been if they got any kind of quarterbacking play. I mean, Kyle Orton's gotten them a couple of wins, I guess, against the Vikings. He had a last-second touchdown as well, and certainly better than E.J. Manuel. But there's something going on there in Buffalo if they had some sort of offense, it seems like.
That does seem the case. You would think that they should be able to go out and find a quarterback that would want to play with a team that, by rights, they're going to be 9-7 rather than 10-6. But still, hold out faint hope that they beat New England in the final game if the Pats have nothing to play for. But you know, it's a fantastic defense. I think it's the best in the NFL right now. They have in Sammy Watkins, they have Megatron like wide receiver. Like he does have oodles of talent.
Has Doug Marrone saved his job with this performance, even if they do finish on the outside of the playoffs looking in? Because there were a lot of people that said it's not about, you know, having an above 500 record this year, although the expectations were so low for this team, and then they came out of the gate and knocked a whole bunch of people out of their suicide pools by beating the Bears week one. But
he's safe. He's not losing his job.
Yeah?
Yeah. Even, you know what? I think even if they lose the next two, he's not losing his job. He's given them a ride. You know, I don't think there was an expectation that the Bills were going to give fans any sort of ride this year.
Let's look over at the NFC, which is interesting in its own right. We're into here week 16, and only one team has clinched a playoff spot, and that's the Arizona Cardinals. A lot of conversation about how great the Packers have looked at times, and Aaron Rodgers may be going to win an MVP, and they still are alive in that NFC North, but they lose the tiebreaker right now to the Lions because they've won their one matchup, and they play them in week 17 in a game that's probably going to be flexed to Sunday night. But right now, Green Bay is sitting in that second wild card spot in the NFC with Seattle, and the 6-8 New Orleans Saints are in the 4 seed leading the NFC South. And we know what's going on in the NFC East with that big win for the Cowboys over the Eagles last week. Maybe that's a good place to start, because now it seems like the Cowboys maybe aren't home and cooled out, but they have the inside track, right, at winning that division title. And maybe this is the week that they can salt it away with a win over the Colts, because they have the Redskins week 17 in a team they should beat, although they have lost to them once this season. This is Tony Romo, though. And it is Shakespearean, right? But it's Shakespearean. Garrett, last week we thought it was going to happen, right? They blew the 21-point lead. Eagles took the lead. But Tony Romo reversed the script, came right back, and they won the game. Is that just setting us up, though, for a stomach punch for Tony Romo in these final 2 weeks?
I think it's Tony Romo. This is the ultimate less is more season for him, right? We really have seen a different quarterback there. And, I mean, that team has obviously surprised a lot of people. I mean, I think there were some train wreck predictions for Dallas, but, you know, you're right. Shakespearean probably is the right word to use. And, we kicked off talking about the Leafs and how many times they've been burned. Dallas is kind of, you know, the same thing with their December games. But I don't know. I'll jinx them and say it looks like it's a different version of the team. It's a different version of Romo, different approach. And I think they can make it through these last couple of weeks without something catastrophic happening.
I don't know, calling it Shakespearean, we'll probably lose our subscription base at Stratford, but
fair enough.
It is a weird situation in that, the two wild cards in the NFC might be the two best teams.
Right.
It stands right now, that's what it looks like.
And it could be a flip-flop of a couple of years ago when it was the Seahawks with the losing record winning that division and hosting the New Orleans Saints, who were heavily favored, and then beating them. You could have the reverse this year where Seattle's going to have, 11, 12 wins going on the road to a sub-500 Saints team. Yeah. And maybe the Saints flip the script, which would be shocking. But, it's going to be a fun couple of weeks. And Saturday games this week in the NFL before a whole bunch more tomorrow. And then the Monday night are a pretty good one this week as well. Colts are Denver Broncos and Cincinnati Bengals. Gents, it's been great. Thanks a lot for this.
Thank you for having us.
This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live. Coming up next, I've got an edition of Sportsnet Today for an hour, 12 to 1. We'll have Mike Wilner talk a little more baseball and what's going on with the San Diego Padres. I'm Ben Ennis. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live. Garrett Joyce and Ryan Dixon on the Sportsnet Radio Network.